agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
Love the government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, a professor of political science at Northern Kentucky University. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, Cleveland area attorney and defender of freedom, Jay Carson, as well as by Chase Law Suppressor, suppressor. My gosh, you're not a law suppressor, Ken. You are a law professor, and we're going to try this one out, and champion of justice, Ken Katkin. Ken, I just felt like, you know, we've been talking about those monikers, right? And you've been looking for one, and Trey's been mentioning it. And I couldn't say defender of freedom, Jay Carson, and, you know, Ken. So I thought I'd try out champion of justice. So there you go.
We'll go with it. We'll go with it for today.
Okay. That sounds good. That sounds good.
Yeah.
I was going to say freedom fighter, but that didn't sound quite right either. So anyway, thanks both of you guys for being here today. And so before we get started with our show today, I just wanted to mention thank you for everyone who filled out the listener survey over the last few weeks. We're going to keep it open one more week. Note or the link will be in the show notes. And on today's show, we're going to be talking about the retirement of Justice Breyer and what that means. A couple of big cases the Supreme Court is going to hear on race and college admissions. A federal judge blocking oil drilling lease sales and what that means. A whole bunch of economic developments and a story that's near and dear to my heart because it involves my all-time favorite president, Teddy Roosevelt, and the removal of his equestrian statue in front of the New York Museum, and a bunch of listener questions as well. But before we get started with all that, we will just take a quick break and we'll be right back to kick things off. Okay, so this week, Justice Stephen Breyer announced his retirement from the Supreme Court at the end of the court's current term, provided that his successor is confirmed by that time. The 83-year-old justice is the oldest member of the court, and the second oldest is Justice Thomas. He's around a decade younger. And Breyer's been on the court for 27 years, second to, well, Justice Thomas, who served just over 30 years. At the White House on Thursday, President Biden said, "The person I will nominate will be someone with extraordinary qualifications, character, experience, and integrity. And that person will be the first Black woman ever nominated to the United States Supreme Court. It's long overdue in my view. I made that commitment during the campaign for president, and I will keep that commitment." The president said he expects to choose a nominee before the end of February. Now, Supreme Court nominees are typically chosen from the ranks of federal appellate court judges, and at present, there are only 10 Black women serving as circuit court judges, and that's out of 179 total positions. And I should mention that President Biden actually nominated 5 of those 10 women currently serving. So, Jay, I want to start with you on this one. What are your thoughts on Breyer's retirement and also President Biden's pledge to nominate a Black woman to fill his position on the court?
Well, on the retirement, I guess I say I, you know, wish him well, right? I mean, he's served for quite a long time. I disagree with a lot of his decisions, but I don't think there's any question that he was is a devoted public servant and you know, doing the best for justice by his lights as he sees it. And I think he was you know, in many ways, again, I did disagree with on things, but a class act and concerned about the integrity and impression of the court in public life. So I you know, in that respect, I guess, you know, that's the warm, fuzzy piece of it. On the politics of it, I think it makes sense, too. He probably realizes that this is his last shot for that would allow Biden to choose someone without having to run the gamut of what's likely to be a Republican Senate. So I think, you know, it was well timed there. And he also, I think, waited long enough, or at least as long as he could, so that his retirement did not appear to be in response to some of the the baying of those on the far left, screaming for him to get out, because I think that would have been a bad look as well. So I think it's well timed. Politically, as for Biden, well, that's a whole other issue. When we made that pledge back in the campaign, I think we talked about it back then. And, I think these kind of statements are counterproductive, to the state of race relations in America, to the state of everybody getting along in America. He sort of seems to make the mistake that, George Bush did the one time, of sort of reading the stage directions, message I care. He could simply have appointed a black woman and said, this is the person I feel most qualified, the best person to be on the Supreme Court. And it would have been, I think, a more powerful statement than saying, I'm going to nominate a black woman, sort of the most qualified black woman I can find. And there's a difference there, and it's a not too subtle difference. Does it change the equation, the political equation? No, not really. But it does sort of, makes it look a little more crass, right? That this is kind of politicking, to have campaign promises to racial groups. I think is a bad way to go.
Okay, Ken, what's your reaction?
Did you want me to just talk about the nomination, or did you also to talk about Justice Breyer?
Yeah, both of those things, I guess, that Jay commented on. I wanted to get your take on those as well.
Yeah, I mean, Breyer, there was an op-ed I agreed with a lot that was in the New York Times by Linda Greenhouse, that where the headline was, Stephen Breyer was the right justice for the wrong age. And her argument was that he was just an excellent justice for the 20th century, and not really he was out of place on the 21st century court. And I agree with that. I think his kind of insistence that the court is above politics and is not political, that's an ideal. And if other justices on the court had the same insistence, I think that would have been a very wonderful thing. But I think on the court that he found himself on, I don't know how helpful that was, and I think, even as Jay was talking about his decision to delay his retirement by, a year after Biden got elected, so that it wouldn't seem like he's saying, well, it matters so much to have a Democrat on the court, because his whole viewpoint was that that shouldn't matter. But yet on today's court, it matters incredibly much. The justices vote on party line votes. The things they write in their opinions are less and less important, because those arguments are these days all mainly window dressing for decisions that are already made on partisan lines. And I think that, to sort of be as Pollyanna-ish as he was about everything towards the end was not a great fit for the times that he was on the court. So that's kind of my take on him. And I do think, however, he was a class act of the old school, and he really did try to, decide cases by deep dives into facts and law, and that made him probably a little more likely than some other justices on the court to be willing to sometimes vote not along partisan lines, or to frequently try to forge compromises when there were still justices on the court could forge compromises with. He really rose to the occasion during the year when, after Scalia died, when McConnell blocked the Garland nomination and there was a 4-4 court. During that period of the 4-4 court, I think it was Breyer more than anybody else who was able to keep that court functional and not just have every decision wind up 4-4, because he was able to work with Justice Roberts and Justice Kennedy, and they were able to forge a lot of actual majority opinions when they had a divided court. I think if there'd been a divided court for longer, Breyer would have been much more in his own time. But I you know, that's kind of my take on him. I am glad that he is retiring now and not waiting any longer. I think it is important for the country that President Biden get to put somebody on the court right now. And that would be in jeopardy if Justice Breyer didn't retire now. But I know he really, really chafes against it, because I think he feels like he put in not only the 28 years you talked about, Michael, on the Supreme Court, but 14 years on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit before that. And I think, you know, all that he really is getting at the end of his career is just everybody in the country saying, get out of there, get out of there, get out of there. And I think he would have, you know, I think it really chafes against him, both because I think he wanted a little bit more of a victory lap at the end, and also because he doesn't really like the idea that it's as political as all that.
Sure. And I think, you know, there's a difference between the people who are saying get out of there because, well, you look at the Ginsburg example and saying, if only people on the left, if only she had retired, we'd be in a different situation, as opposed to there being sort of a decline in his ability to do his job. And that, of course, has been an issue in the past with some Supreme Court justices, though not for a while. But that really wasn't the case here. You know, on the issue of President Biden's appointing to appoint a black woman. You know, Jay, you mentioned saying, well, it would be much better if he said, well, I'm just appointing this person and this is the best person for the job. And it just so happens that person's a black woman. You know, I've thought back to George H.W. Bush when he appointed Clarence Thomas to the court, when he nominated Clarence Thomas to the court. And he said with a straight face that Clarence Thomas was the most qualified person for this position. And I know a lot of people just thought, well, that just is, you know, not the case. And so, you know, when I think we think about this, the idea that there is a most qualified person, the one in the country,
yeah,
I think that's just kind of a silly argument. What I think is that there is a pool of people who will do a perfectly fine job in that position. And, you know, some of them happen to be female, happen to be black and so forth. And I think there's a case to be made for, an argument to be made that diversity on the court really can, other things, we'll get to the diversity issue in our next story, but other things being equal, diversity can be meaningful in a couple of ways. One, certainly symbolically. I mean, there was a reason why George H.W. Bush appointed Clarence Thomas, right, for the position that Thurgood Marshall had held for so long. But also, I believe people from different backgrounds can actually bring something to the deliberations and discussions that maybe, you know, that wouldn't have been brought to them otherwise. Ken, what do you think about that, the President Biden's, you know, definite plan to nominate a black woman?
Yeah, I kind of agree with parts of what each of you said. I actually do agree with Jay that I would have preferred to not see him announce that as rigidly as he did. Not so much because I'm as worried as Jay about the racial divisiveness of it, but more because I think it actually diminishes the nominee.
You know, amen. Yeah, no, yeah, that's, yeah.
Yeah, I think that if he presents, it'll probably be Ketanji Jackson. If he presents her as being the best African-American woman I could find, you know, from the pool of 10 possible people out there in the country, I just think that makes it seem like she isn't, you know, she's not on the same level,
yeah,
as the other justices that were chosen for different reasons. So I don't think that's helpful. I think it would have been better if he would have been saying, I'm looking to get the best candidate I can and to get someone who will bring different things to the court than it already has. And, you know, I do believe it's going to be Ketanji Brown Jackson. And among other things, not only does she bring more racial and gender diversity to the court, but she's going to be the only justice who was ever a public defender. She has experience as both a district judge, federal district judge in a trial court, as well as federal appellate judge in a U.S. Court of Appeals. She brings a lot of different kind of experiences that other justices don't have. And so she's the obvious pick, I think, on any level of kind of what merits. And so I just don't see what good it does for her or for her confirmation process to say, you know, this was the best out of the African-American women that were available.
It's sort of saying, and again, this is what I find trouble. And again, I think you're hitting on sort of exactly the same point that I am, that sort of saying, well, here's my affirmative action hire.
Right.
And that's that I think sends a contrary message to the message that he should send. And as you pointed out, I do think that's the meaning to the nominees. You know, to Mike's point, I think there is value in diversity on the court. And if you look historically, there has always been sort of each seat has sort of its own provenance, if you will, right? For years, there was sort of the Jewish seat. That's what it was. Frankfurter, Brandeis, so forth. And the same pattern, I think, happened when Thurgood Marshall retired. I think George Bush felt that he really ought to, in honoring the representation of having an African American on the court, nominate Clarence Thomas. And I think the other point, Mike, you're exactly right on, is that, you know, there's a wide pool of people who would be fine Supreme Court justices. And it's not, there is not an objective best Supreme Court nominee, right? It's not like the NFL combine, right? Where you can say, well, this person, you know, runs the 40 and this much. Although that would be really cool if they did it that way.
Yeah.
But no, it's not like you can say this is the best person. Rather, you say this is someone who is eminently qualified for the position from a legal standpoint. And there's necessarily political calculations that go into it as well. And those political calculations are ideological. There's a racial piece to it. There's a other demographic piece to it. There's the age piece to it. You know, so no, there's a lot of things that go into being an ideal candidate. But I again, I just find it the it's sort of offensive that just the, and I guess I shouldn't say offensive because that's not the word I want to use. You know what I mean? Imagine if you're applying for the job and the first two questions on the job application are what's your race, what's your gender? I think that sort of goes contrary to what we want to see in this country.
Well, you know, and I think part of this is what you might call a pipeline issue, because certainly minorities and women are underrepresented in the judiciary, and that's for a lot of reasons. And I give President Biden a whole lot of credit for working very hard to find highly qualified people. And if you take a look at it, President Biden's appointments or nominations to the judicial branch in general, I mean, he's at a pretty blistering pace, fastest, I think, since Reagan, I believe, at this point. And the vast majority of his nominees are women and or people of color. And I think that's a good thing, because there is a large pool of people. And we want to try to do, I think, whatever we can to make that pipeline wider for historically underrepresented groups in the judiciary and really in a lot of areas of life.
I'd recommend Janice Rogers Brown of the D.C. Circuit, but
yeah,
pretty sure she's not going to be the pick for a number of reasons.
I want to talk a little bit about, because a judge, you mentioned Judge Jackson, Ken, and she was just recently, I think it was in this last summer, she was appointed to the confirmed to the, I forget which appellate court, but anyway.
It's the D.C. Circuit.
Okay, the
U.S.
D.C.
Court of Appeals for D.C. Circuit.
So sort of like the AAA team for the Supreme Court there, I suppose. But, you know, in that vote, she actually got, I believe, three Republican senators who voted to confirm her to that. And that was Senators Lindsey Graham, Susan Collins, and Lisa Murkowski. And so I think it'll be interesting to see what happens if she is, in fact, a nominee, and everything suggests that she is certainly is at least a front runner, whether or not she would potentially get any Republican support. Jay, you are our House Republican, at least today. What do you think of the possibility of there being any Republican support for, well, Judge Jackson or any conceivable Biden nominee?
I think there's certainly a possibility for Republicans to support. For a couple reasons. One, this seat doesn't change the ideological balance of the court. So it's going to be, I would say most Republicans don't see this as a hill they want to fight on. Now, that could depend on the nominee and, you know, how the nominee does in the confirmation hearings. But I'd say starting from scratch, and look, I don't know much about the potential nominees other than, well, here are the names that have been floated and here are the courts that they've served on. Right. You know, we haven't done any sort of deep dive. But look, because so many of these potential nominees were recently nominated, they've been vetted. They've been through the process. It's unlikely that there's going to be any big surprises that come out. And I really think most Republicans would look at this as this just isn't a fight worth having. Democrats are going to have the votes. And I think there's something to be said for the principle that, listen, a president can appoint a justice who is qualified, and we may disagree with that person on some ideological points. But I think you ought to, and I'm not speaking for the Republican Party by any means, right? This is, I'm just a guy on a Saturday morning podcast. But you ought to start with the presumption that a president gets to appoint someone who is qualified, and you take it from there.
Yeah. Go ahead, Ken.
I was just going to say about, and I do think it's going to be Ketanji Brown Jackson. So just in terms of, I'm sure she'll get at least the same three Republican votes that she got when she went up for circuit court. And that was actually her second Senate confirmation, because she had previously been confirmed to the U.S. District Court for D.C. And in that confirmation, she was confirmed on a voice vote unanimously. So every senator voted for her the first time she was confirmed, or at least everyone who voted. Appellate court, of course, they it's more partisan, and so a lot voted against her. But when you were talking about how there's no best person for the job, that may be true, but I would say there's no person in the United States better qualified. Sure. Than Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson. There may be people equally qualified, but her qualifications compare favorably with most of the other U.S. Supreme Court justices. I mean, let's take a look at them. You know, she was top of her class at Harvard College, top of her class at Harvard Law School, law review editor at Harvard Law School, clerked on all three levels of courts. She did a clerkship in the United States District Court. She did a clerkship on the First Circuit Court of Appeals, and she clerked for a justice on the Supreme Court named Stephen Breyer. Uh-huh. She worked as a law firm partner. She worked as a federal public defender. She worked as a lawyer for the U.S. Sentencing Commission, and she's been a trial judge and an appellate judge. Like, I just don't see how qualifications could be any more sterling than that. And so to the extent that, and also as a judge, both a trial judge and you know, she's only been an appellate judge for a short time, but she was a trial judge for a decade. I don't think she's done a lot of work that the Republicans are going to be able to really complain about that much. And finally, she is, a relative by marriage to former House Speaker Paul Ryan. And he's shown up at all her hearings to testify for her. And I don't know if he still carries any weight with Republicans or not, but she's certainly going to be having some Republicans at her confirmation hearing supporting her nomination.
That rhino, Paul Ryan. I want to ask you, there's this is kind of a little bit of a side thing, but Harvard law professor Larry Tribe, a while ago, this is when Trump was president, made the argument that Vice President Mike Pence didn't actually have the authority to break a tie vote over the confirmation of Justice Barrett. And Pence was actually the first vice president to cast a tie-breaking vote in a lower court judicial confirmation. This was in December of 2018. And I thought that was I will charitably call it a novel argument. And certainly Larry Tribe is no shrinking violet, likes to get his name out there. But Ken, you're our constitutional law expert. What do you think about that argument, which I think is, potentially more relevant given the fact that certainly it's not implausible to see a 50-50 vote on this? What do you think?
Well, I wish you would have told me that before we went on air today, because the truth is, it sounds implausible to me, but I haven't read I don't know what Tribe's argument was. I don't know what his substantive argument was for that position, but it doesn't follow from a natural reading of the text of the advice and consent clause, I don't think.
That was kind of my take as well.
I think Tribe's argument essentially was nominations are different. That the vice president can break a tie in regular Senate business, but the advice and consent is sort of a separate function. And it is assigned to the Senate, not sort of the Senate plus one. I'm sort of with you. I don't know that there's any there, right? I think it would be sort of a strained reading to say that it couldn't. But like Ken, I haven't done a deep dive into it.
And I would think even if I would be stunned if there weren't some group after whomever. President, but if there were a 50-50 vote with Vice President Harris breaking that tie, I'm sure there was some group who would try to challenge that, but I would be completely stunned if the courts actually declared it anything but sort of a political question.
On that. But, and it's not going to be a 50-50 vote.
Yeah, and of course, there were some people who were saying, hey, you know, a black woman who could serve on the court would be, well, the vice president, and that would be dealing with some on the left calling it, they seeing as an inconvenient problem for President Biden, though I think that's just kind of crazy talk. One of the things that is a little more substantive, I think, is I should point out that none of President Trump's three nominees to the Supreme Court won significant bipartisan support. Right? There were three Democrats who voted to confirm Gorsuch, one voted for Kavanaugh, that was Joe Manchin, and no Democrats voted to confirm Barrett. And if you compare that to President Obama's appointees, Kagan in 2010 received 5 Republican votes. Sotomayor in 2009 got 9 of the then 40 Republican senators voting to confirm. And so, you know, I looked at that and I said, well, what if anything, can we take away from that? And Ken, I know this is a topic, the confirmation votes on Trump-appointed judges and justices you've spoken about in the podcast in the past. So I wanted to get your take on that.
Yeah, not just Trump-appointed ones, because other than Chief Justice Roberts, there's not a single Republican justice on the court other than Roberts who received a filibuster-proof majority of votes, but whereas every Democrat did. But we,
that was because the filibuster didn't matter by the time we got to those later Republican justices.
No, it mattered because the Democrats could have filibustered Thomas. They could have filibustered Alito. They could have.
But certainly not Kavanaugh or Gorsuch.
No, but the point, my point is that the Democrats weren't playing that kind of hardball, and the Republicans routinized that. The Republicans would not allow. We're going back decades now. Stealthily, the Republicans would not allow any Democratic appointees that they could filibuster, whereas the Democrats didn't wake up to that. They weren't routinely filibustering every Republican nominee that they could. And that's had a hugely distorting impact on who's on the court. We only have centrist Democrats. We only have far right Republicans other than Roberts.
What do you think, Jay?
I'm not sure I get where Ken's coming from or what the point is. I mean, certainly.
To me, let me try to sort of explain it from how I see it, because I think this is an important point. It seems to me that the argument is that the reason why we see so few Democratic votes for Republican nominees is that in Ken's argument, and I think there's something to this, especially on higher courts, Republicans have been more comfortable nominating extremists who can't attract significant bipartisan support, as opposed to Democrats who have been more likely to nominate center-left people who can attract bipartisan support. And so, in other words, the Republicans' radicalization of politics in general has extended into their radicalization of the courts much more so than on the left. That's the argument as I understand it. And so, maybe you can kind of react to my interpretation of Ken's argument, whether or not that is his argument.
Yeah, that's a good summary of my argument.
Okay.
Well, I guess I would sort of see it the other way, that Democrats have dug in, and Democrats for many years, I think, played the judicial game better than Republicans did in holding firm against, right, the nominations of a president. And I guess I don't get the Democratic vote against Amy Coney Barrett completely. I think is sort of symptomatic of, look, this is someone who for them the court is about abortion. That's what the court's there for, and she is opposed to that, and therefore no one Democrat senator could vote for. I mean, unless you somehow find her to be an extremist, which I don't think her record would show. Neil Gorsuch, certainly, I don't think you could paint him as extremist, nor Kavanaugh in his actual writings. I mean, there were the allegations against him, but there's nothing that is, I would say, extremely ideological about Kavanaugh. He's certainly to the left or the center of, say, Clarence Thomas or Scalia. So I'm not sure I.
Well, let me
again,
try
maybe,
to.
I don't understand the assignment here, but
let me try to push back on that at least a little bit, because I think you can certainly make a plausible argument saying that someone is an extremist if they hold what I believe, say it's a senator or anyone, to be a completely incorrect view on an issue of absolute fundamental importance in constitutional law, and whether that's the Second Amendment, Certainly, I think it's not unreasonable to say this is such an important, such a fundamental constitutional issue. And if this person is just dead wrong on this, that is something that makes them objectionable, literally. I'm not saying I necessarily hold that. I think that's right.
I mean, I think that's, but I, you know, I guess I'm so yeah, I, that's what I'm saying is I, the Democrats in the Senate would all vote against Amy Coney Barrett because they cannot, in good conscience, vote for someone who would likely find Roe to be incorrectly decided.
I'm not sure what. I think it's kind of, we can look at this
significance
from, right.
I mean, the same thing could be said of, listen, there have been plenty of Democratic nominees, and the game is, what do you think is, because this correctly decided? And of course, no one, you can't really say. But look, everybody knows, what the position of the nominee is in reality, or the general mindset that they bring to it, right? Every case and controversy is different. But I don't think there's anybody who would expect a Joe Biden nominee to say, yeah, maybe Roe was incorrectly decided.
Yeah, well,
right?
I mean, yeah,
or
sure.
To do that, and vice versa.
But I mean, I agree, but I also think we need to consider both ideology and sort of how the nominee views their role as a justice or as a judge, because certainly, there's someone like, say, a Chief Justice Roberts who has pretty much all of those conservative views, but is, I would say, and Ken, you might disagree, but is far less comfortable with judicial activism in many instances than many of his, well, all of his colleagues, right-wing colleagues on the court. And so I think that's an important distinction to make. Ken, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I that's what I was talking about. That you've got, I think other than Roberts, I would say the other four are extremists in a number of senses. Number one, I think they have absolute contempt for democracy. I would say they give essentially no deference.
You got to be careful with that kind of stuff.
I think it's true. I think they give no deference to Congress. They don't enforce any statute that they don't agree with. They don't generally defer to the president in areas where statutes give the president discretion. I think they pretty much vote the Republican Party. I would say platform if the Republicans still had a platform. But I think they the Republican Party agenda is pretty much what they vote. And I think the recent COVID stay is like an it's a great example of that. I mean, the statutes could not be plainer, and yet all these textualists, you know, wouldn't follow a statute, wouldn't follow the typical deference to the president. You know, and I think that's sort of an example of what we typically see. We see it so much that we don't see it anymore, that it becomes invisible, just like because it's trying to see a tree in a forest. And I do think they're extreme, and I think that Democrats were not even when they voted in very substantial numbers against these nominees, they didn't use the filibuster. Whereas, you know, no Democratic justices are like that. So you have the Democratic justices may try to, you know, maintain the court's precedents or may try to push the law to the left a little bit in the interstices where there's ambiguity. But they don't just completely have total disregard for precedents, total disregard for Congress. And I think that's the court that we have right now. We don't really have a court that's very interested in the rule of law or in the precedents of the court.
Well, you know, I wonder if I wonder if we could say, or some people would argue the same thing about, if not maybe Breyer, at least on some issues, there was an analysis by political science Jeffrey Epstein and a few other folks who found that he was actually the most centrist of the three left of center judges, and in fact, in some criminal issues would kind of break with the platform, if you will. But if you consider, say, you know, Judge Sotomayor, Justice Sotomayor, Justice Kagan, before them, you know, Justice Ginsburg, I can see people from the right making essentially the Ken's argument just the other way around, saying, well, these people, they just vote the Democratic Party platform, basically. And so there really is no distinction. And the only person who can be counted on to sort of be, in fact, if you look at the modern court, you could maybe make a case that the only two justices that are sometimes unpredictable were actually Republican appointed justices. That'd be Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kennedy.
Historically, it's much more likely that you see Republican-nominated justices joining with the liberal justices than the other way around.
But I also wonder if that's because those justices are a little more uncomfortable, or were more uncomfortable breaking with precedent. A lot of those precedent and those big cases happen to be maybe more liberal type of precedence, I guess. And I'm not sure that might not play a role in that as well. Ken, you know, I particularly wanted to get your response to my argument, which I don't necessarily entirely believe. I'm not sure if I believe it, but I thought it was important.
Here's what I would say. I think that in the Warren Court in the 1950s and 60s, it would be fair to accuse that court of liberal activism, right? I like a lot of things the Warren Court did, but they were definitely making big changes in constitutional law and getting out ahead of the elected branches. I think that's the only time in American history that the Supreme Court could be fairly accused of liberal activism. And I think what we've mostly been up against in the post-Warren Court era is the fact that Congress from the 1930s to the 1960s did in fact enact a lot of liberal statutes. Congress was dominated by Democrats during those periods and liberal Democrats at that, FDR and LBJ, and that the major part of the Republican conservative judicial activism in modern times has been just completely repealing those statutes that Congress has never repealed, has been nullifying the statutes. And that's, I think, extremely, that's part of the war on democracy and on the rule of law. In other areas like abortion, I could see how you could say, well, it was really, you know, Warren Court, although that was actually Burger Court activism that gave us that, and all they're doing is undoing that. And I could see that argument. But even there, you know, you've got, you know, big areas of law where big changes are being made right now from decades and decades of settled precedent, not only abortion, which I think is going to go away this term, but we're very likely to see highly invigorated gun rights, where, you know, the Supreme Court never before has interpreted the Second Amendment to protect any right other than the right for law-abiding people to keep handguns in their houses. And I think we're about to see, you know, very novel kinds of opinion, giving us open carriage and concealed carriage everywhere. So I think in constitutional interpretation, we're seeing big changes. But I think the biggest impact of the lawless court is not so much on constitutional interpretation, but on nullifying statutory interpretation.
Okay. And Jay, I can hear your objection to Ken's the lawless court thing, but let me maybe before we move on to our next story.
Mike, and I weigh in on this, Ken, and as lawyers, first of all, this show, I know we have federal judges who listen to this show. We have Ohio Supreme Court justices who listen to this show. And I'm not comfortable making statements that courts are lawless, that they're at war with democracy. I'm fine saying, listen, I disagree with this decision or that decision, or I think it departs from precedent, or I think the court gets it wrong. But there's a line that we ought to, and this is something that Mike, you and I talk about, respect for institutions. I am an institutionalist in this, and I do have to bristle when Ken says things like lawless court and war on democracy and all that, because if this is there are plenty of court decisions that I've disagreed with and I think are wrongly decided, but I hardly think it's a war on democracy. So I'm sorry.
No, I think certainly bristling is understandable, but I also think it's important to keep in mind that to a lot of people, a lot of very intelligent, well-intentioned people, this is exactly what Ken describes as. Now, you and I may not agree with, you disagree with it more than I do, certainly, but it is, it's an important perspective to have out there to realize that, well, just because we may not agree with it doesn't mean that a lot of people don't feel that is exactly the case. And so I think, there's a distinction made between disagreeing with that perspective and saying it's not a valid perspective, because I think to millions of Americans, it absolutely is a valid perspective, even if I occupy kind of a middle ground between you two guys here, certainly, and maybe that, that puts me in a good position to kind of moderate, I think, this part of our discussion. But before we do move on, one thing I think we can't all agree on, all agree on, is given the current composition of the court, this is unlikely to really change anything in terms of short-term outcomes and rulings of the court. Would that be a fair thing to say? Do you guys think, Ken?
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, agreed. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, on that note of agreement, we will move on to our next story. But before we do that, we will just take a quick break and be right back. So moving on to our next story, also court related. Early this week, the Supreme Court announced that it would consider two lawsuits challenging racial preferences in college admissions. The suits, filed by a group called Students for Fair Admissions, allege that Harvard and the University of North Carolina impermissibly discriminate against Asian American applicants. Now, Students for Fair Admissions is asking the court to overturn the court's holding in Rutter versus Bollinger from 2003, where the court held that schools can use race as a plus factor in admissions based on a compelling interest in diversity on college campuses, but only if such policies are narrowly tailored and there exists no race-neutral way of meeting the objective of increasing diversity. And finally, I should note that 9 states actually have banned affirmative action, including California, liberal bastion. This happened over a quarter century ago when California approved Proposition 209 by a nearly 10-point margin in the statewide referendum. And in 2020, actually, a measure to repeal Prop 209 was defeated in another referendum, this time by nearly 15 points. So I want to start this one with you, Ken. Since you are a resident constitutional law expert, what's your view first on the court's ruling in Rutter versus Bollinger? And I forgot to mention that was a 5-4 decision along ideological lines. And do you think that was correctly decided? And do you think that this is going to be an instance where the court overturns or modifies that decision?
Well, I do think the court will overturn that decision. Yes. I actually don't think that Grutter was a correct decision, but I don't think I like where the court's going with it either. I think the true correct decision on this issue is an older decision called Caroline Products, which used to be the leading case on equal protection law. Although I think that's another one of these areas where the modern court has really has disregarded that old doctrine. But Caroline Products, which is a case from the 30s, has a very famous footnote number four.
Footnote number three. Yeah. I wanted to beat him to it.
Yeah, number four actually. But but that used to be the famous footnote four, which is the most cited footnote in Supreme Court history, lays out a kind of theory of equal protection, which I think is correct, but which Grutter following Bakke moved away from, and I think the court is going to move even a lot farther away from it now. But the correct theory would be, in my view, that the Equal Protection Clause is rightly understood as being about a safeguard against one of the sinister aspects of having a democracy, right? That democracy is generally a good system. Majorities should generally rule. But that one defect in democracy is that sometimes majorities could, because they have prejudice or bias or animus against discrete and insular minorities, they will just use their majoritarian power to codify discrimination against despised minorities. And so on that viewpoint, one of the purposes of the Equal Protection Clause, using again the experience of the actual framers and ratifiers of it during Reconstruction in trying to protect African-Americans who had just been freed from slavery against all kinds of race discriminatory laws that were then called the Black Codes, that were later called the Jim Crow laws. The concept would be that that should be an exception. When you see laws that codify prejudice against discrete and insular minorities, then that should be an exception to the presumption of majority rule. And that the purpose of the Equal Protection Clause is to protect discrete and insular minorities who can't protect themselves because of their small numbers majoritarian discrimination. And I think that's the correct understanding of the Equal Protection Clause. That was the court's understanding of the Equal Protection Clause for about 50 years. But that starts changing with Justice Powell's lonely opinion in the Bakke case that actually no other justice joined. All other eight disagreed with it. But because the others split 4-4 for different reasons, Justice Powell's lonely opinion that he was the only vote for in the first affirmative action case started the court on what I think was its wrong direction of moving away from Caroline. And again, under Caroline, it would have been always permissible for white majorities to decide voluntarily to try to provide some help to discriminated against minorities that have been discriminated against in the past in order to try to overcome the ongoing societal impact of past discrimination. Something like that would have been always permissible because that wouldn't have been seen as something that's codifying majoritarian bias, animus, or prejudice against discrete and insular minorities. So the concept that of the Equal Protection Clause could prevent white majorities from legislating benefits to discrete and insular minorities would have been unfamiliar to equal protection law until Powell's opinion in the Bakke case. But the Grutter case actually changed Powell's lonely opinion in the Bakke case into the court's doctrine. I think that was a mistake. I think the idea that the Equal Protection Clause functions exactly the same way to protect some white people against other white people who decide to give benefits to minorities, I think that's craziness. So I don't think there's any constitutional restrictions against any kind of affirmative action program. And I don't think any Democratic justice other than Powell himself, who was a Dixiecrat, I don't think any Democratic justice has ever signed on to the theory that was in the Grutter and Gratz cases.
Jay, what's your reaction to that?
Well, I think one, I appreciate the shout out to Caroline Products, discrete and insular minorities. And I think Ken's right on the if you're just talking about a plain equal protection analysis. But we also have in this case the Civil Rights Act that prohibits discrimination on the basis of race. And what these plaintiffs in the case are showing is, listen, we as Asians are being disproportionately prevented from gaining access to this school that accepts federal funds on the basis of our race. They have a system which shows, and they've got the there's a lot of statistical analysis in this, showing the scores, the grades, and so forth, and basing, you know, here are how Harvard does its admissions. And it's also, it's not a matter of, in this case, you know, white people passing laws to keep minorities out. This is a case of you have an institution saying we're choosing this minority over that minority. And that is discrimination by race, sort of by its very terms. And that would seem to be expressly forbidden by the Civil Rights Act.
Yeah, but Michael, I'd like to say I actually agree with Jay about a big part of that. So I actually do agree that what Harvard is doing in its admissions process, as found by the courts in the First Circuit, might well violate Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 64. I actually do agree with that. But I don't think that's where the Supreme Court is headed on this case. I don't think they're going to, you know, Justice Breyer, who I guess will hear this case, that's the kind of thing he would look at. He would say, well, let's look at the facts of the case. Let's look at the statutes. Let's see how the statutes apply to the facts of the case. But I think the conservative majority on this court is just going to not look at the statutes, not look at the facts, and just make a big ideological statement about the Constitution and say the Constitution requires a colorblind rule. They're not following a colorblind rule, and therefore what they're doing is unconstitutional. And I think that's going to be a crazy interpretation of the Constitution, even though I actually agree with Jay that if they would just look at the statutes and apply the statutes, I think the plaintiffs actually have a very strong case here.
Couldn't you argue, from just a strict textualist sort of interpretation of the Equal Protection Clause, that it is, in fact, just a colorblind? It doesn't mention anything. You know, there's no footnote to the actual Equal Protection Clause, right? And that's just a gloss that an unelected justice put on that. And so therefore, the simplest rule, and going right by the text, just says, hey, this is a colorblindness sort of thing, and there's nothing about protecting insular discrete minorities. I wanted to get first, Jay, your thoughts on that, and then Ken, your comment on that.
Yeah, no, I would absolutely go with the straight textualist approach, and I'm thinking of Justice Harlan's what was called the Great Dissent in Plessy versus Ferguson, where he said, look, by his lights, his readings of the Equal Protection Clause, the government has no business knowing the race of anybody it's dealing with. He would have gone with a completely colorblind view. And you know, again, he was dissenting in Plessy. Yeah, I think that's the case. And in Caroline Products, again, you're talking about discrete and insular minorities, which, you know, typically it's been a sense of these are folks who are, you know, by the terms discrete and insular, it's not simply they're a minority. They are, you know, sort of set apart. I mean, and I don't think that's the case that's really before the court in the Harvard case, right? I don't think there would be the argument that either of the minority groups that essentially are duking it out are either discrete or insular. To the extent one is, I think you'd argue that Asian Americans are just by the numbers more discreet and insular than African Americans, but I don't know that comes into play. I disagree with Ken in that I don't think the court gets to these larger pieces. I think they look to the statute and will say there's nothing. You know, Harvard's practice one goes against the plain language of the statute, and in this case there's no. There's no, I guess, government action, right? That the government is somehow taking an action to to ameliorate past discrimination. At least that's not what I've seen from the, you know, I did a quick look at the briefs the other day, but it seems more that just they have the expansive view and the view that the Asian students' numbers are wrong. So
Ken, what do you think?
Yeah, there's a lot to disagree with there. first on the government action side of it, the Supreme Court intentionally consolidated the two cases. There's the Harvard case and there's the University of North Carolina case, and they gave cert before judgment in the North Carolina case just so that they could make sure to consolidate the two. And I think University of North Carolina, of course, being a public university, and the Bakke case, which has sort of been the Powell opinion, Bakke, that I mentioned earlier, that's a 1979 case that gave us the modern approach, which I think is a wrong approach. That case actually says there's no difference in the doctrine that would apply under the Equal Protection Clause and the doctrine that would apply under Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 64. Now, that holding may be superseded by the Civil Rights Act of 91, because Bakke was a 1979 case. Congress made a number of amendments to the Civil Rights Act, the older 1964 version of the Civil Rights Act in 1991, to try to reverse a whole lot of the court's holdings in the 80s, mainly, that had been, you know, the court kept ruling against the claims of kept ruling in favor of various reverse discrimination claims brought by white people, and Congress tried to overrule all those cases in the 91 statute. So I don't know that the provisions of the 64 statute would still be interpreted the way they were being interpreted in Bakke. But on the other issue about government action, I think I do expect this court to say Equal Protection Clause, Title VI, are back to being interpreted identically again, and there is an equal protection issue in the North Carolina case, and so the holding of that will apply to the Harvard case. But also on the idea of African Americans not being discrete and insular minorities, which I think is also something that Jay said, I find that beyond laughable. I mean, the African Americans are the archetype for discrete and insular minorities. It's who the phrase was written to be about. The very concept of the framers, the very concept of the 14th Amendment was to protect African Americans against Jim Crow laws. There's no concept that they must have been thinking about protecting other people, not African Americans. And Caroline was using that phrase to talk about protecting African Americans. And then finally, Mike, on your idea that textualism has anything to do with this, I find that highly implausible also. The word race doesn't even appear in the Equal Protection Clause. It's not clear what kind of equality we're talking about here. There's no reason, based on a textual standpoint, we should think we're talking about racial equality. You have to be bringing in some kind of historical analysis rather than textual analysis to get to that point. And I think it's right to do so, but I think it's crazy to call that textualism. If we went by the text, then, you know, equality either means that it's a violation of equality for the University of North Carolina to deny admission to anybody. Why would race be the factor under the text, right? Either everybody should get in or everybody should not get in, because otherwise people aren't being treated equally, or else you need to have some kind of theory that comes from something other than the text, but doesn't come from the text, about what the Equal Protection Clause actually protects.
You know, it seems to me, too, and kind of pulling back a little bit, the reason why we are in this situation, in a sense, is what I would see is the more fundamental inequality problem or inequity problem of, well, K through 12 education and funding and resources. And we see huge disparities and Jay, I can hear you making the argument that, well, that's more of a socioeconomic thing than a race thing. And there's certainly a high correlation between those two things in most instances. But I think that a lot of these problems, in a way, go away if we deal with the problem where I feel like we should be dealing with, and I will really try hard to avoid getting on my soapbox about, you know, property tax-based school education funding formulas and all that. But to me, that's kind of at the crux of it. And I wanted to either of you have any thoughts on that?
That would vary from state to state and district to district.
Sure.
I would agree that historically that's an issue. I would disagree in terms of just because I'm sort of familiar with a lot of the Ohio per pupil funding numbers and where they go and state aid and so forth. That in many cases there are vast resources that are pointed towards urban school districts. So I do think that is a separate policy question. I'd also note that look, with the Equal Protection Clause, to the extent we're talking about this as a, you know, this is the 14th Amendment was passed, right? Specifically, and he's right. Specifically to address equal protection of the laws for former slaves. So I guess I'm with you on the textualist thing that look, that's what it says, but absolutely. The better our society does in terms of K-12 education, I think the more equality we have in our society, which is a good thing.
You know, Mike, one thought that I had when you were talking about that, and now we're really moving into policy and away from the Constitution, I think. But I have my doubts about affirmative action as a policy matter as well. I have no doubts that it's completely 100% legal as a matter of constitutional law. But I have some doubts about whether it's a good policy. In part for some of the reasons that you said, and I think. You know, one problem I have with affirmative action is that although we would like to think that one of the benefits of it is that it's helping advance people socioeconomically, that it's helping people from disadvantaged backgrounds move up. I don't know that that's how it always works. I think it does work that way at the most elite schools. So, you know, if you have Harvard having affirmative action. You know, there's a great longitudinal study of this issue by Bill Bowen, he's an economist who used to be the president of Princeton, and he did a longitudinal study on what happens to people who get into the Ivy League schools based on affirmative action, and he's basically able to chart the course of their lives and show that they are actually greatly benefited by that. But I think if you look at different kinds of universities, you start to see different kinds of results. And, you know, I think Texas is a really interesting example you know, when George Bush was governor there, he more or less destroyed the affirmative action program at the University of Texas to get himself some political points with Republicans. And what he did was he said, well, they should stop admitting, giving a race preference in admissions. But what they should do instead is they should just admit anyone who graduates in the top 10% of their high school without regard to any other factors. Doesn't matter how they do on the SAT. Doesn't matter if they do any activities. Doesn't matter if their teachers recommend them. Doesn't even matter if they have criminal records, et cetera. And the concept was to leverage the fact that the high schools in Texas are still de facto segregated. And so you'd wind up, you know, with most of the minorities in Texas going to majority minority schools, and you'd get some minorities into the University of Texas and be able to say that you had a colorblind admissions process. But even though the whole thing was reverse engineered to make sure that you still had some diversity, which so it wasn't really motivated by colorblindness, it was a total failure. Right, that you end up admitting, you know, although you're admitting some socioeconomically diverse students that way, substantially all of them were unprepared to go to the University of Texas, and substantially all of them failed out. The ones that came from the failed inner city high schools that were majority minority, and that's why that Texas had to keep kind of rejiggering that and had to keep going back to the Supreme Court again in subsequent cases. And so I think there's limits. Because of what you said, Michael, about the enormous disparities we see in K-12 schooling, and I think the fact, I believe it's still a fact today, it certainly was as recently as 5 years ago, that most students who are minorities in this country have to go to majority-minority high schools that are majority-minority. That it's only a minority of minorities that get to go to integrated high schools, and so you have such lapses in preparation that's available that it leads to all kinds of problems, no matter what kinds of admissions policies you use in most universities.
You know, there's a sort of a semi-related issue here that I wanted to get into because it just sort of sticks in my craw. I don't know why exactly, but this a type of discrimination or preference that's very common in elite schools, Ivy League and other non-elite or non-Ivy elites, is the practice of giving preference for legacy applicants. In other words, if you had a parent or sibling that went, then you get a little bump in your possibility of being admitted. And of course, I think a lot of people rightly say, well, these are the last folks who actually need that bump because they've already gotten so many other advantages. And it seems to me that, I mean, this is a big thing. The Harvard Crimson not too long ago called for an end to legacy advantage. And but it's a real common thing. It seems to me, I think you can make a good case for, say, legislation that prohibited, you know, student federal aid or government research funding to any institutions that consider legacy status as a plus thing. I would love to see that. I kind of wanted to get your thoughts on that, guys. What do you think, Jay?
Oh yeah, no, I think that's a bad road to go down. That you would somehow just give preference to that. I mean, it's essentially, look, there is a hidden code there, right? Also that, hey, you're an alumnus and we sure appreciate your support. Now do we say we eliminate it? I think you can eliminate it as a factor, and that's fair to everybody. So,
Ken?
Well, you know, I have mixed feelings about it. So both my wife and I, we both went to Ivy League colleges, and neither of us were legacy admits. But then that meant that for our own kids, they could have been legacy admits at two different Ivy League colleges, because my wife and I both went to different Ivy League colleges. And they both chose not to apply to those colleges because they actually didn't want to be admitted as legacy admits anywhere. And I admire that a lot. On the other hand, and they both went to different Ivy League colleges, but what I do think, though, is that one piece of this where I would somewhat have some sympathy for the legacy admit system, even though I didn't use it and my kids didn't want to use it, is I actually do believe it yields some significant benefits to the universities, because a lot of those families that have longstanding ties with the most elite universities are also, you know, big donors to those universities. And the money that is donated to those universities is used for the benefit of all the other students that get to go there. And also many of the kids that are admitted as legacy admits, you know, really, you know, would be competitive to be admitted whether or not they were legacy admits anyhow. So if you're looking at a system, you know, like at my alma mater at Princeton, where they get, you know, 20,000 applicants, all from, you know, not maybe not all, but at least half from very extremely well-qualified people who would do really well there anyhow, and they can only admit 2,000 out of the 20,000, then, you know, I think in some extent it becomes a little bit of a coin toss about who do you take. And so I don't see that there's great harm or great injustice being yielded by saying, okay, you've got, you know, a legacy admit, and you've got another kid who's not a legacy, and they're more or less equally well qualified. And if we didn't use legacy as the tiebreaker, we'd have to use a coin toss as a tiebreaker. You know, I don't think that delivers great injustice, and I think it does deliver some you know, significant benefits to the universities, which are beneficial to other people. So I don't actually think it's all bad, but nonetheless, I do think you know, I do still admire my own kids for, you know, choosing not to make use of that. Sure.
You know, I want to, before we move off this topic, another issue I think is we really haven't talked about is, what do we mean by diversity? Because the whole rationale for this, whether or not you agreed with the court's most recent precedent on this, is that that universities do, in fact, or can, in fact, in instances, demonstrate a compelling interest in diversity on campus. And I think that's an important word to think about, because what do we mean by diversity? A guy by the name of John McWhorter, who's a black man, who's a linguist, he writes for the New York Times and other things. He recently made the argument saying, you know, what kind of real diversity is are we talking about here, where we have, I mean, he said my kids are basically the same as any other rich, affluent, well-educated white kids. The color of their skin just happens to be different. And what sort of diversity is this really bringing to Harvard? And, you know, should we be expecting, you know, black or other minority students to be kind of, you know, performing in a way or kind of acting in a way, saying, oh, you know, here is your helping of diversity, oh, white majority, you know? And so is that somehow, you know, wrong, or is that in any way beneficial? Is this real diversity, I guess, is the question. And I think so often when we talk about diversity issues, we just sort of think, well, by definition, if someone looks different, then their inclusion is diversity. And I wonder if that, you know, is always true, or to what extent that may be more or less true. What do you think about that, Jay?
Oh, I think it's less true. And I think the Grutter's reliance on diversity as a basis for affirmative action, I think was misplaced. And there's some really good, some of the amicus briefs that were filed in the Harvard case sort of take on that point. And they even take a look at studies of university officials and administrators who all sort of said, listen, this is it's not really that there is a interest in actual real diversity. There was an interest in continuing an affirmative action. I think that's one of the reasons Grutter ought to be overruled, because I think that whole idea of, listen, we're replacing what had been, right? The rationale for affirmative action always had been, listen, this is making up for some past injustice. And Grutter took the position of, well, there's also a government interest in students going to learn in a diverse area, or in a diverse pool of other students, that they learn something from being around students from different backgrounds, different races, etc. And there may be something to that, but it was never really fleshed out. And a lot of the arguments in the Harvard case, are made to that point. There's a particularly good brief filed by Peter Kirasana, who's a member of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission and a Clevelander, that really I think was well done. So I recommend that to people. But I think that diversity in and of itself, I just don't think anyone's ever really fleshed out what advantage is it that you're seeing there, right? It's the policy they're implementing does not match the goal that they claim to be promoting.
Yeah, and Ken, before I get to you, the reason part of the reason I asked this is because I've sort of been exposed to this in a number of settings. I've almost for my entire life been employed in some way, shape, or form by some sort of government institution, whether it's the Marine Corps or academia. Talk about, you know, very different. But in thinking about the meaning of diversity, my exposure to diversity, racial diversity in the Marine Corps was very much an immersive sort of thing, and actually working with people on a regular daily basis of very different backgrounds and races and so forth. And that, to me, felt like a diversity, an exposure diversity with meaning. Whereas when I think about classroom settings or campus settings, oftentimes you see students sort of self-segregating. And I wonder if that sort of exposure is anywhere nearly as meaningful as the sort of exposure that you get when you are literally working together with people under very oftentimes difficult circumstances that you would get, say, in the military or something like that. Ken, your thoughts?
Yeah, well, again, I want to kind of separate the legal issue from the policy issue, because they don't work the same way for me. But I completely agree with Jay that the diversity justification, which Justice Powell argued for in Bakke, and which the majority adopted in Grutter, I don't agree with that test. I said before, I think Grutter is wrongly decided, and that it followed an unfortunately wrong approach that one justice in Bakke had pioneered. And I, you know, Jay also kind of disparaged the idea that affirmative action should be about remedying some past social injustice or something. But
quite the contrary. Okay. Yeah, my point was historically that was the legitimate use of affirmative action.
Oh, okay, good. Yeah, I apologize then, because then we're going to agree more than I thought. Because to me, you know, you have still the work of the Reconstruction that needs to be finished, right? I mean, you have 400 years of slavery, and then the 14th Amendment is there to try to, after the 13th Amendment frees the slaves, the 14th Amendment is there to try to actually bring the African Americans who've been freed up to a level of legal, and I would also say legal, social, socioeconomic, political equality. To integrate the African Americans into mainstream American society so that hopefully we can reach the point of that colorblind society. But that work never got done, right? I mean, we're still here, you know, of 150 years after Reconstruction, and most minorities still have to go to segregated schools. Most minorities are socioeconomically extremely far behind where most whites are. Although we're now talking about, you know, there's a few federal judges who are African-American, you know, in the halls of power, you know, there's essentially very few African-Americans. There's very few corporate CEOs who are African-American, you know, all that work of bringing African-Americans into parity with whites so that we can move towards that colorblind society is very unfinished. And so I think under a proper interpretation of the 14th Amendment, The idea that work can still be done, including based on race, as of course the framers and ratifiers of the 14th Amendment did do. They adopted freedmen's bureau programs where benefits were given out based on race to the newly freed slaves so that they could be trained up for jobs and get help moving and things like that, get help voting even, so they could become more integrated into society. And these benefits were not available to white people. You know, that idea that you need to take account of race to move people from slavery into equality, I think, is part of the Equal Protection Clause and is the correct justification for affirmative action. I don't think these diversity justifications are very important or meaningful. And I do think that the effect of the Bakke and Grutter Doctrine is to make college admissions offices have to obfuscate and hide balls about what they're actually doing. So I fully agree with Jay about that analysis of diversity. I think it's not a meaningful or useful concept.
Okay.
And Mike, if I can just chime in one more thing, the Peter Curasano amicus brief that I mentioned a minute ago, he makes the exact same point that you did, that in many cases, this move towards diversity, as stated, results in more segregation, actual more segregation, self-segregation on campus. And if the goal is to have an integrated society, these programs seem to be working against that.
Okay. Well, on that note of universal agreement, maybe that's a cue to move on. Actually, we are at the end of the free ad-supported segment of the show, and we're going to get to a whole bunch more on the full episode. So if you're a Patreon supporter, that's going to be coming up in just a minute. If you're not, we would encourage you, if you can, to become a Patreon supporter, patreon.com/politicsguys. And if you can't afford to become a Patreon supporter, just send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com. Comment, I will get you set up with access to the entire episode for all of our episodes. And once again, we would really appreciate if you could take the listener survey. It's going to be the last week it'll be up. So the link to that will be in the show notes. Thank you very much.